NPR's business news starts with another media company headed for bankruptcy. This time it's Freedom Communications in financial distress. That's the parent company of the Orange County Register, one of Southern California's leading dailies and the winner of three Pulitzer Prizes. Other media outlets are reporting that Freedom Communications could file for bankruptcy this week. Freedom Communications was founded about a century ago by a man named R.C. Hoyles, who wanted to promote his libertarian philosophy.
He went on to control 30 newspapers and 8 television stations around the country. But today, Freedom Communications faces the harsh realities of the free market. In this case, falling ad revenues. The company is still mostly owned by the descendants of Hoyles, and the family is now working with its lenders, including the bank J.P. Morgan Chase, to restructure about $770 million of debt.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. A few weeks after the financial meltdown began last fall, a book started creeping up the bestseller lists. The book was Karl Marx's anti-capitalist opus, Das Kapital. And yet, while Karl Marx is widely considered one of the most influential political philosophers in history, his close collaborator, Friedrich Engels, is often overlooked. Well, historian Tristram Hunt is hoping to put an end to the slight. His new biography of Engels is called Marx's General, and Tristram Hunt is in our London bureau. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
The influence of Karl Marx's writings on the 20th century can't be overstated. How much was Friedrich Engels a part of that?
Well, this is one of the very interesting debates, the degree to which Engels's interpretation of Marx influenced what became Marxism in the 20th century. And a lot of people found it rather easier to read Engels than it was to read the great Leviathan of Das Kapital. And if you look at the leaders of European socialism in the early 20th century, and indeed American socialism, a lot of them go to Engels first. And there is this disagreement as to whether Engels misinterpreted Marx and led the way towards Leninism and Stalinism, something I disagree with profoundly. But I think whichever way you cut the cake, the influence of Marx was profound, but it was also in a very uncomfortable direction. And what we're seeing at the moment is the rediscovery of Marxian thinking in another age, as it was in the mid-19th century, of unregulated global capitalism.
Friedrich Engels came from a wealthy family in Germany. How did he become radicalized?
It was first of all really through losing his religion. He grew up in a pious, conservative, religious household, strongly Protestant. He lost that as a late teenager and discovered in the philosophy of Hegel a supplement for the faith he had lost. And from Hegel, he went to the radical end of Hegelian thinking amongst the young Hegelians. And then he really came to Marxism by living in Manchester and discovering the condition of the working class in Manchester, those exploited in the mills, in the factories, those living in the terrible tenements, those experiencing a life expectancy of only 26 years.
And in Manchester, he is actually working for the family business.
This is the great irony, that Engels is himself a cotton lord.
There's a textile company.
Absolutely. Part of, you know, that huge textile industry in Manchester. And Engels always found that tension between him as a bourgeois, as a capitalist, and then his communist thinking. Mm. And Engels writes a very interesting paper on political economy. It catches Marx's eye. And the two of them meet in 1844 and begin, without doubt, the greatest friendship in Western political thought.
This is a meeting in Paris that you describe in 1844. They have these 10 beer-soaked days reveling together in Paris.
Beer was a big part of Marx and Engels' relationship. They were both big drinkers. Engels really a sort of Teutonic, almost, you know, Prussian figure in his consumption, and Marx a far angrier drinker, a more depressive drinker. But the two of them found that these ideas were fueled together, and those were the happiest times they had in Paris in the mid-1840s, in Brussels, and the hope of revolution and the chance of change was always there for them then.
And just a few years after they meet in Paris, of course, you have the series of uprisings across Europe, the 1848 revolutions. Did these two men believe that this was the start of their dream?
Absolutely. I mean, they were delighted with the course of events in 1848 when European nation after European nation begins to cascade towards revolution. And they thought this was the beginning of a process which might lead towards a socialist revolution. And Engels himself is on the barricades while Marx is in the editor's chair issuing pamphlets and denouncing reactionaries. Engels is actually on the barricades back in his hometown fighting for revolution. And, you know, this old thing of having bullets whistle past you and making him a man, and he's delighted that he actually sees revolution. So he's not just an armchair revolutionary.
Those revolutions, of course, fail, and the two men return to England. Marx, you write, begins work on Das Kapital. Engels basically agrees to bankroll him. You write that he was so enthralled by Marx that he almost subsumed his own interests and priorities for him. Why is that?
This is the fascinating crux of the friendship. They come back from the 1848-49 revolutions. They see revolution is a long way off. They agree that they have to lay out their political manifesto. And only Marx can do that. Marx is the genius. But Engels knows that if Marx is going to do that, he will have to pay for it. And so he goes back to the family firm, and he has these terrible 20 years of working in the cotton industry, exploiting the working class, and then funneling all the money down to Marx behind his parents' back. So you have these wonderful letters where in one letter Engels would rip up a £5 note in half and send that, and then send the other half the day later in case it was stolen in the post.
You describe Engels as a man who sort of lived a paradoxical life. You call him a frock-coated Victorian cotton lord. He was a man who liked a fox hunt. He enjoyed fine wines, haute cuisine. You talk about Chateau Margaux 1848, for example, as his drink of choice.
On the one hand, there is this contradiction of Engels as a fox hunter living the high life, and then also trying to instigate a proletarian, a socialist revolution. On the other hand, Engels' vision of socialism, like Marx's vision, wasn't the kind of doer, dowdy, Puritan vision that it came in so many labour and socialist movements in the 20th century. It was about humanity fulfilling its capacity. It was about fun. It was about enjoyment. And the point was to spread those riches, to allow the working classes to have Chateau Margaux, to allow the working classes to go fox hunting, to have the fun of human capacity rather than the terrible grind, the immiseration, the exploitation he saw all around him in the Manchester mills and factories.
Tristram Hunt, could Karl Marx have become Karl Marx, the one we know today, without Friedrich Engels?
I think the ideas would have been there to a certain extent, but I think what Engels provides is the way those ideas worked out on the ground. Engels provides the evidence. He's the one in Manchester seeing how the wage system works, seeing how capital fluctuates, seeing how stock markets function. And he feeds all that back into Marx's thinking. But crucially, he's also the one who goes further, trying to develop Marxism as a political project. And he's an organiser. He's working there in the First Internationale. So I think Engels is crucial. We'll never know, you know, could Marx have been Marx without Engels? But I think you miss a great deal if you take away Engels from the historical picture.
Tristram Hunt is the author of the new biography, Marx's General, The Revolutionary Life of Friedrich Engels. He spoke with us from London. Mr. Hunt, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. When members of Congress get back from their August recess after getting an earful back home about health care, they can expect a rowdy reception on Capitol Hill. Conservative activists launched a cross-country bus tour on the West Coast this weekend. They've dubbed it the Tea Party Express, and they plan to be in Washington just about the time lawmakers return. NPR's Jeff Brady spent the weekend following the bus tour through Nevada.
Tea Party Express organizers say they're at the leading edge of a new political movement. Sometimes they refer to Ross Perot's presidential bid in 1992 as inspiration, but it's also a patriotic roadshow that always begins with the national anthem.
What so proudly we hailed.
A political action committee from California is sponsoring the bus tour. Mark Williams is a talk radio host and an officer with the Our Country Deserves Better PAC. The goal is to bring together different groups concerned about what he calls heavy-handed government policies.
Our country deserves better. We figured it's time for somebody to run to the front of the parade and say, follow me, and to try to herd all these cats into at least a semi-coherent message.
The Tea Party Express attracted several hundred people to its rally in Elko Saturday night. President Obama visited this small town of 20,000 people three times during the campaign. Still fewer than a third of voters here picked him on Election Day. At the Tea Party rally, there were few, if any, fans of Mr. Obama and plenty of critics. Sherry Hussey held a sign that read, "No more closed roads." She's upset public land agencies are blocking off roads for environmental reasons.
The federal government wants to close more of our roads, and I have three little girls. We camp, and we hunt, and we fish, and we play on four-wheelers, and I have every right to use public roads on public lands.
Across the lawn, there's a man wearing a T-shirt with President Obama's face on it. It reads, "Don't tax me, bro." There were also people holding signs criticizing government involvement in health care and excessive federal spending. The scene a few hours away in Ely was similar. This is a place where people are comfortable using language most others left behind with the end of the Cold War.
We don't need a communist nation. And that's what Obama's taken us to. We don't want that.
That's Jeanette Cobb of Eureka, Nevada. She and her husband, Robert, are both retired. He says government control is a big issue for him.
Every time you look at the news, I think Friday, they're talking about taking over the Internet in an emergency. Well, who declares an emergency? I don't want my government to have that much power.
The development of a cybersecurity bill in Congress has been widely reported in conservative media as a power grab by the White House. Supporters of the legislation say it's designed to make it more difficult for hackers to disrupt business on the Internet. Tea Party Express chief strategist Sal Russo says people who come to these rallies aren't super focused on specific issues. He says they're motivated by broad ideals.
I think there's a feeling that getting a bigger government, a higher taxes, a more intrusive government is the wrong way to do it, but that's not the answer. I think that's probably a unifying thread.
And here's another one. A lot of people attending these rallies say they feel left out, as if no one in Washington is listening to them anymore. Jason McGowan is a machinist from Carson City, Nevada. McGowan says the Tea Party movement is something he can feel a part of.
Before this really happened, the news media made me feel like we were the minority and that what Obama wants, that's what everybody wants, and that I should just shut up because that's what everybody wants, you know? So it's kind of nice to know that there's other people out there that think the way I do.
The Tea Party Express will motor through about two dozen more cities in the next week and a half, arriving in Washington on September 12th for what the group calls a taxpayer march on D.C. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Ely, Nevada.
Broadway musicals have an unlikely champion, Spike Lee. The filmmaker was so taken with a show called Passing Strange and its star, a singer-songwriter named Stu, that he turned it into a movie. Our critic, Bob Mondello, suspects audiences will be glad he did.
Stu is a large African-American man, red shirt, black suit, appealing voice. He's the author, the songwriter, and the subject of Passing Strange.
Cue music.
Also the onstage narrator.
Sunday morning, South Central L.A., 1976. Mother stands in doorway. Youth is sleeping.
Wake up! The characters he's describing materialize on stage near him. A young man, also in a red shirt because Stu's tale is largely autobiographical, and a mom who almost immediately gets on your nerves.
Now jump out of that bed and come a-churchin' with me.
She drops the Negro dialect and speaks in her natural voice.
It's such a beautiful Sunday morning.
With that shift in tone, Stu lets you know that he'll be approaching this coming-of-age story with a twist or two. The middle-class Los Angeles teenager will grow up to be a lot like the adult singer-songwriter who's telling his story, but that doesn't protect him from a certain amount of mockery after he leaves a church choir, for instance, to form a punk band.
1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm at war with Negro mores, I'm at war with ghetto norms, my mother stands in doorways begging me to conform.
Our hero's path to adulthood takes him on a Candide-like journey to Amsterdam, where his middle-class world gets slightly exploded.
We just had sex. That's right, all three of us.
And to an art commune in Berlin, where he goes through a little hell and emerges with an epiphany.
See, I'm cursed to entertain. The crowd laughs too soon. And all I have is my pain, sharpened way out of tune.
You'll note that Passing Strange finds a musical style to suit each mood swing. It also has an impressive array of staging tricks, to which Spike Lee adds considerable pop and sizzle on screen. The director filmed two performances on Broadway, then shot the show again without an audience present to capture close-ups and offbeat camera angles. The cast is knocking itself out, and the strikingly edited result is theater magnified, amplified, brought to a kind of life that doesn't usually happen for theater on screen. I should admit right here that I'm a theater nut, so this particularly appeals to me. And I should also note that I had an opportunity to see the show live, and I passed on it. Boy, was I wrong. And boy, am I glad that Passing Strange has passed my way again. I'm Bob Mondello.
Who lends the club that speakeasy air? The black one. The black one, who dances like a god and has wunderbar hair, Der Schwarzer. Now he's the life of every soiree. He'll give the bums rush to your ennui. Turn off these lights, 'cause I barely can see the black one.